The Spanish Civil War is often described as the inaugural conflict of World War II, and it's the only time that thousands of Americans have voluntarily joined in another country's civil war. In Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939, Adam Hochschild interweaves the history of the war with the personal narratives of some of the Americans who fought there and of those who reported from there. Mr. Hochschild is the author of 7 books, including King Leopold's Ghost, To End All Wars, and Bury the Chains, and he's a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine. His new book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Hello.
Good to be with you.
Didn't you know several Americans who fought in the Spanish Civil War?
I did. One of my first jobs was as a newspaper reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle in the 1960s. And there were 2 older reporters of the paper, both 30 or 40 years older than me, who were American veterans of the Spanish Civil War. And when things were slow in the newsroom, I used to ask them about their experiences. And during the decades after that, there were 2 other vets whom I got to know very well, were good friends for many years.
Did you ever meet Delmer Berg, the last known American to fight in the Lincoln Brigade? He died a few weeks ago at the age of 100.
Right. I never met him.
Our listeners may have read John McCain's recent op-ed tribute to him in the New York Times. Came as a bit of a surprise.
It sure did, although not a complete surprise, because McCain has always told people that Hemingway's novel of the Spanish Civil War, For Whom the Bell Tolls, was one of his favorite books. And it's a tribute to McCain that he wrote this tribute, because I think the handlers of almost any politician, at least any Republican politician, would say, for heaven's sakes, don't write an op-ed in the New York Times praising somebody who was a member of the Communist Party. But I think McCain is smart enough to know that it would have been a good thing if the Spanish Republic had won the Civil War.
And he's no longer running for president.
That's true.
In 1936, the Spanish people elected a coalition of liberal, socialist, and communist forces. How far to the left was it, and how close an election was it?
They won a decisive win in the election, even though the right wing was very heavily financed. At that time, it was a coalition of left and liberal parties known as the Popular Front. The Communist Party did not loom large in that coalition. They only had, I think, 16 members of the legislature. They gained much more influence later on because once the Spanish Civil War broke out, in other words, once this cabal of right-wing generals revolted against the elected government, the United States, Britain, and France would not sell arms to the Spanish Republic. The only country that would was Stalin's Soviet Union, and in return, he demanded and got high positions for Spanish communists in the government and in the armed forces.
And many people who came from the Soviet Union fought also in the war, including Josef Broz, Tito. Didn't he get his name Tito because when he was in the Spanish Civil War?
It's a little bit obscure just what Tito did in the war. He certainly was part of the process of recruiting the international volunteers.
How soon after the election did the generals led by Francisco Franco begin their revolt?
About 4 or 5 months. The elections were in February of 1936. And keep in mind that Spain had, for 5 years at that point, been an electoral democracy after many centuries of monarchy and a bit of military dictatorship. In July 1936, this very well-coordinated revolt, a large group of right-wing army officers rose up and tried to seize power, and in fact did seize power in about one-third of the country. And then very quickly, Hitler and Mussolini rushed them all possible support, arms, planes, pilots, tanks, tank drivers, artillery, and Mussolini sent 80,000 ground troops as well.
Thousands of Americans signed up to fight for the Republicans. Did any Americans volunteer to fight for Franco?
There are only 2 or 3 that are known. One was a pilot, one was in something called the Spanish Foreign Legion, and then deserted. Tiny handful.
Tell us about the Texaco oil executive, Torquild Reber. How was he involved in helping Franco?
This is an almost entirely unknown story of this war. Even today, historians tend to skip over it just in passing, and there are pieces of it that have only recently come out in recent years. People think of Franco's allies as being in Rome and Berlin, which they were, but a major one was here in New York City in an office in the Chrysler Building. Torkild Reber was CEO of Texaco, the big oil company. And he was basically a fascist sympathizer. He liked strong men, strong dictators. At the beginning of the war, he decided he was going to do business with Franco and not with the other side.
But wasn't it against the U.S. law? He had an American company.
He headed an American company. It was not against U.S. law to send non-military goods to a country at war, but it was against U.S. law to send them in American ships. Reber violated that. Nationalist Spain had no tankers, so Texaco tankers carried this huge supply of oil. They would leave the Texaco pipeline terminal at Port Arthur, Texas, ostensibly bound for Amsterdam or Rotterdam or Antwerp. At sea, their captains would open sealed orders redirecting them to ports in nationalist Spain. And he also supplied all this oil on credit, which was a further violation of U.S. neutrality legislation. He supplied it at a big discount, which was unknown to Texaco shareholders, and as far as we can tell, unknown even to the Texaco board of directors.
A number of neutrality acts were passed in the 1930s and 35, 36, 37, 39. Except for 39, were any of the others in specific response to the Spanish Civil War?
Yes. In early 1937, some legislation was specifically in response to the war, making clear that the requirement for the U.S. to stay neutral, not sell arms, and so on, applied to a civil war as well as to another country at war.
Were people aware of what Reber was doing? Why was this completely ignored by the press?
Not in the slightest. I think it was ignored by the press because reporters covering wars tend to practice a kind of herd behavior. I've reported a lot from overseas myself, occasionally from conflict zones, and I've noticed that reporters hang out in packs. They tend to report the same stories. And the reporters in Spain, and there were hundreds of them from around the world, they competed with each other in covering the siege of Madrid and various other crucial battles.
Many of them were in total sympathy with the government.
They were. But they never asked the question, where is nationalist Spain getting its oil? Whose fuel is powering those bombers that are bombing us here?
Because it wouldn't be Germany or Italy, which were importers of fuel.
Exactly, exactly. And it would have been very expensive for Hitler and Mussolini to advance Franco the money to buy this oil. They never asked that question, and it should have been obvious. And they never discovered then, nobody discovered then, it only came to light decades later, that Reber and Texaco were also supplying nationalist Spain, Franco and his people, with a stream of strategic intelligence that was passed on to bomber pilots and submarine captains because Texaco, being a multinational oil company, had offices, installations, tank farms, and ports all over the world and was able to find out when shipments of oil were heading for the Spanish Republic.
So then pilots could torpedo those boats.
Exactly. And in one or two cases, we can actually trace the loss of a tanker heading for Republican Spain to information supplied by Texaco.
I'm speaking with Adam Hochschild. His latest book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How many volunteers came from countries other than Spain to help the democratically elected government?
Over 40,000.
And how many from the United States?
About 2,800.
So we were just a small component.
We were the fourth or fifth largest country in terms of sending volunteers. The largest number came from France, which was right next door.
Were the Americans recruited, or did they volunteer individually?
They volunteered, but the Communist Party of the United States did the organizing of this. And, party members put out the word that volunteers especially those with military experience, would be welcomed. Not very many did have military experience. A few thousand foreign volunteers, including a few from the United States, more from other countries, made their way to Spain independently and joined militia units run by other political parties in Spain.
Many came from New York City. In fact, many came from the City College of New York.
That's right. I believe City College of New York students, faculty, staff, alumni totaled some 50 or 60 people. Probably a third to a half of the American volunteers came from the greater New York area.
Did they pretty much share the same reasons for volunteering?
I think so. People in the world at that time were very alarmed by the spread of fascism. Hitler had come to power in Germany in 1933 and immediately started saying nasty things about the Jews, started talking about expanding Germany to the east, showing Russia who's boss, and so on. Mussolini had been in power in Italy since the 1920s. In 1935, he embarked on a war of conquest and acquired himself a colony, Ethiopia. Much of Eastern Europe was under regimes of the extreme right, usually with an anti-Semitic tinge. Portugal had a right-wing dictatorship. Fascism seemed to be spreading.
But people also were aware that Stalin was committing crimes.
Well, not everybody who should have been was aware of that. It's true that the Soviet Union was a horror show, but the real truth about the extent of the great man-made famine there, of Stalin's great purge, didn't really sink in, especially to true-believing communists, until quite a bit later. But the Soviet
Union, he signed a pact with Hitler Germany.
That's right. But the Soviet Union, for all its faults, which were considerable, was not embarked on a war of conquest.
At that time.
At that time.
A lot of people, idealistic people in this country, had become communists because of the Great Depression. But why did they call themselves the Abraham Lincoln Brigade?
Well, some people wanted to give it a different name. They wanted to call themselves the Tom Mooney Battalion after Tom Mooney, who was a labor martyr who was in prison in California. But the Communist Party felt it needed an all-American name. After all, Lincoln was the leader of a country who was victorious in a civil war. When a second battalion was formed, they called it the George Washington Battalion. The Communist Party was always trying to out-American everybody else in its choice of names. It used the Liberty Bell insignia as a badge it gave to family members of the people fighting in Spain.
Did these volunteers receive any military training?
Very little. Very little, because they were desperately needed. They were rushed into battle. The American battalion got to Barcelona in the mid-January of 1937. By late February, they were under fire, taking terrible casualties. They had no proper rifles to train with. They were just allowed, at the very last minute, they got some rifles just before they went into action, were able to fire a few shots, but that was it.
Did the Roosevelt administration express any feelings about all of these, well, not all of these, but a fair number of Americans volunteering to fight on the communist side of a revolution?
Well,
it was also seen as an anarchist side.
Right. The Roosevelt administration had a hands-off policy. Roosevelt himself certainly was deeply opposed to fascism, but he knew that isolationism was very strong in the United States. It's believed that he promised the Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, before the 1936 election, that he would not intervene in any way in Spain. It was one of these promises. If it was made, it was never put down on paper. And whatever he felt in his heart, he still did his best to keep the United States completely neutral, maintain the arms embargo, not sell the Republic arms. In January of 1939, just before the war ended, he told a cabinet meeting, "We made a grave mistake."
Why was the Catholic Church such a big supporter of Franco? Was this across the board? Was this Italy as well?
This was pretty much across the board.
The Vatican was in support of Franco?
Yes, because, in fact, the Vatican was one of the first regimes to recognize, first places to recognize his regime, because Franco's particular brand of fascism, in fact, one could even argue whether it could be called fascism because of this, included a huge role for the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church hierarchy in Spain was deeply reactionary, the most so anywhere in Europe. And the Spanish Republic was very anti-clerical. And in fact, once Spain had become a republic with an elected government in 1931, one of the things they started doing was taking education out of the hands of the Catholic Church, where it had been up to that point. Franco put it all back in the hands of the Church, and the Church backed him wholeheartedly. You can see photographs of bishops and cardinals giving that outstretched arm salute along with his generals.
What was the reaction of the American public? Was this discussed much?
It received a huge amount of news coverage. Were
these people seen as heroes?
Volunteers? For many Americans, they were.
Although later they were accused of being premature anti-fascists.
They were. But while it was going on, they were treated pretty sympathetically by most of the American public. A lot of returned veterans made speaking tours, raising funds for medical help and this kind of thing. So I think, and the surveys that were taken, the Gallup polls and so on, showed that many more Americans sympathized with the Spanish Republic than sympathized with Franco, but that most Americans didn't have strong feelings one way or the other at all.
Didn't Franco announce that any foreign volunteers taken prisoner would be shot?
He did.
Did he do that?
And he did indeed shoot many of those taken prisoners, including the Americans.
I'm speaking with Adam Hochschild. His latest book is Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Adam Hochschild. His latest book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. What was what were the social conditions in Spain in the 1930s? Had it been as affected by the Depression as other European countries?
It had been. On top of what was a wildly unequal society to begin with, by far the majority of the land in Spain was owned in these huge estates that might be 75,000 or more acres. Millions and millions of peasants had little or no land.
There was a social revolution in northeastern Spain.
That happened at the time of the coup. When Franco and his fellow generals staged this coup in July 1936, it was rebuffed in many parts of the country, especially in the northeast, not by the army of the Spanish Republic, which had mostly gone with the revolting generals, but by militias hastily put together, badly armed, raised by political parties and left-wing trade unions. And when they successfully beat back the coup attempt, these folks found themselves essentially in charge of huge parts of the country. And they put into effect by far the most far-reaching social revolution ever seen in Western Europe. Workers took over factories, including the Ford and General Motors auto assembly plants in Barcelona. Waiters took over restaurants. The dining room of the Ritz Hotel in Barcelona was turned into People's Cafeteria Number 1 for the poor. Peasants took over these big estates. Railway workers took over the transportation system. An amazing thing that was largely ignored by the foreign correspondents on the scene.
Now, most of the people involved in this were anarchists. Didn't the communists actually oppose the takeover of property?
They did. The anarchist tradition in Spain was very strong. Even though it had largely died out almost everywhere else in the world, but it was extremely strong in Spain. The Anarchist Trade Union Federation claimed some 2 million members. This social revolution was very much opposed by both the communists, who only wanted a revolution imposed from above, as it happened in Russia, and by the mainstream parties of the Republic, who were no enthusiasts of revolution to begin with. The communists and the mainstream parties felt, not unreasonably, that if they were up against an army, you know, that was being supplied by Hitler and Mussolini, this was not a time to experiment with revolution. They needed a strong army responsible to a central command and not this hodgepodge of militias loyal to different political parties and trade unions. And eventually things came to blows over this. And in May of 1937 in Barcelona, there were several hundred lives lost. And the anarchists basically abandoned the revolution at that point.
Was Barcelona the largest city affected by the social revolution?
Definitely. It was the second largest city in Spain. I continue to be amazed by how little the foreign correspondents reported on it. The greatest account by an American, the most extensive eyewitness account of what it was like to live through this time as an American in Barcelona, comes from a woman I write about in my book, 19 years old, Lois Orr, college student from Louisville, Kentucky, who a couple of months before the coup had gone to Europe with her new husband on their honeymoon. They were leftists, but of a very independent, anti-Stalinist sort. When the social revolution happened, she said to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband, "We have to go to Barcelona and see this." And they hitchhiked there, arrived there 2 months after the coup, lived there for 10 months. Lois Orr wrote the most extraordinary series of letters home, which her family mercifully kept. She spent much of the rest of her life rewriting a memoir about this period that was never published. And there is no other American that left anything like this in terms of an eyewitness account.
She called her memoir Anarchist Millennium. But how did the anarchists, who don't believe in any form of government, run a large city like Barcelona?
It's a problem, because they also didn't believe in paper money. They made bonfires of paper money. The unions took over the stock exchange and used stock certificates as scratch paper. And, you know,
they demolished the prisons and released the inmates.
They opened the prison gates because they were opposed to prisons. And, you know, you can sympathize with some of these impulses, but it becomes mighty hard to run a modern economy with no paper money.
The book includes a photo showing the dining room of Barcelona's Hotel Ritz converted to People's Cafeteria Number 1. They insisted on speaking Catalan rather than Spanish. So were they appealing to Catalan nationalist impulses?
Well, there were both Spanish-speaking anarchists and Catalan-speaking anarchists. And there were even some Catalan-speaking fascists, although not a whole lot of them. Regional feeling has always been very strong in certain parts of Spain, as it still very much is today. Catalonia, the area around Barcelona, is one of Spain's most wealthy and industrialized areas. And so for many decades, even before the Spanish Civil War, there had been a movement for autonomy and independence there, saying, you know, why are our taxes supporting the rest of the country?
Still is something
very much moment. So same there today, and the same applies in the Basque territory today.
If it was difficult for anarchists to run a large city, how about running an army? In his memoir Homage to Catalonia, George Orwell writes about the attempt to create an egalitarian army. Well, how do you do that where the privates and the generals if they have equal rank?
It can be a
and
problem.
The same pay.
It can be a problem because effective militaries really do depend on people being willing to carry out orders. I think that, you know, you can't really run an army long term, having people voting on decisions that be made and so on. Orwell strenuously maintained that in his particular unit, things worked fairly well, but he was not engaged in a rapid war of movement. There were just a few trench raids back and forth, and so we really hadn't seen this tested on a large scale.
Was he criticized for telling what he saw as the truth about the shortcomings of the Republican cause, including violence and destructive infighting?
He was. When he published Homage to Catalonia in 1938, the war was still on. And for people on the right, the book was, of course, anathema because he had fought for the Spanish Republic. For people on the left, or most people on the left, it was also anathema because they felt you shouldn't air our side's dirty laundry while the battle is still going on, because Orwell, who got caught up in this street fighting in Barcelona and almost was arrested, he knew that the police were looking for him because they were trying to get foreign non-communists and anarchists behind bars or out of the country. This loomed very large for him when he was writing it. And when he wrote the book, he maintained that it was because of this factional division that the Republic lost the war. By 5 years later, he had changed his mind and essentially said, you know, we lost the war because the other side was being supplied by Hitler and Mussolini, and no one gave us any help. And I think today almost all historians would agree with him on that.
Orwell and Ernest Hemingway were the two most famous writers to come out of that war. Was Hemingway a good reporter?
You know, I think he was a much better novelist than a reporter.
Now, he was a strong supporter of neutrality. Did the Spanish Civil War change his opinion?
Absolutely. Hemingway had been previously quite non-political. He hadn't even bothered to vote in the presidential election of 1936.
He wasn't politicized by World War I, he also was participated in?
Not in a way that would make him into a political activist. And he was writing his novels. He was big game hunting in Africa, fishing for marlin in the Caribbean, and so on. But when the coup happened in Spain, he took it personally. He felt this was a country and a culture that he very much loved that had come under attack, and by God, he was going to defend them. And he signed up to return to Spain as a correspondent, made four long trips there during the war, writing for the North American Newspaper Alliance, a syndicate of some 50 newspapers. I think his wartime reportage is not his best work.
How much of his journalism was reflected in his novel about the Spanish Civil War, For Whom the Bell Tolls?
Actually, not a whole lot.
So did we get a realistic portrayal of the war from that novel?
In that novel, I think we did, because Hemingway, and I tell this story in my book, actually at one point went as a soldier on a guerrilla raid behind nationalist lines where a bridge was blown up, just as happens in that novel. He never wrote about it at the time, but he was gathering material for the novel. And I think the novel reflects a much more capacious and nuanced understanding of the politics of the war than he was willing to show in his newspaper coverage.
What about Martha Gellhorn, his girlfriend and later wife, who had a personal friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt? You would have thought that might have led to some changes in Washington's attitude. They worked on a documentary film called The Spanish Earth. Has that film survived?
It has. I believe you can actually find the whole thing online these days.
And it was screened at the White House in 1937.
It had its premiere at the White House, the most illustrious audience for a premiere that we know of, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and a few of their friends. Martha Gellhorn, who had actually lived in the White House for a time before the war, the Roosevelts had the most extraordinary collection of long-term house guests, and Gellhorn's mother was an old friend of Eleanor, and at one point Eleanor said, you know, why don't you send that writer daughter of yours here? She can live with us for a while and keep working on her writing. Gellhorn found that Eleanor Roosevelt really wanted her help dealing with her correspondence because an enormous number of people wrote to the First Lady asking help on one thing or another, and moved out after a couple of weeks. But she retained her friendship, wrote Eleanor a series of letters from Spain during the war, arranged this film premiere there, hoping that this might be the thing that would change the president's mind about the war, but it failed to do so.
The New York Times had two major reporters covering the war, Herbert Matthews and William Carney. Did they bring different political ideologies to their reporting?
They did. They both, in fascinating ways, became avid supporters of the side each was covering. Matthews of the Spanish Republic, Carney of Franco's Nationalists. Carney was also a devout Catholic. And they were each extremely partisan in what they reported. And they occasionally took potshots at each other in print, not directly, because you can't do that in the Times, but like pointing out errors in the other's stories, this kind of thing.
Was having two such different reporters a deliberate strategy of the Times?
Well, certainly the Times wanted to cover the war from both sides, and they were right to do so. And Matthews, for all his faults and his partisanship, was a very intrepid reporter and managed to get to the front all the time, again and again, to be under fire, and contributed some very vivid descriptions of what he saw. Carney tended to stay well behind the lines and to take what he wrote from Franco's press releases.
Was it possible for a reporter to remain objective if there's such a thing? And you write about Virginia Coles, who was one of the few who reported from both the Spanish Republican Nationalist Spanish side. Was she a good reporter?
I think she was the best reporter writing in English, better than Hemingway, better than Martha Gellhorn, better than Herbert Matthews. And the book that she wrote about it afterwards, called Looking for Trouble, still makes very good reading today. She was absolutely intrepid. She didn't believe any propaganda. She insisted on seeing things for herself. She managed to first report from the Republic and then report from Nationalist Spain, which is something very few people managed to do. She had never been to college. She was 26 years old when she arrived in Spain. She played the role of the wide-eyed feminine ingenue, tripping around in high heels and pretending not to know anything, but she was very shrewd.
Why did the Americans have such a high casualty rate?
Because the international brigades that they were a part of were really the shock troops of the Spanish army. These 35, 40,000 foreign volunteers came from many countries. They had volunteered to go to Spain. Some of them, not a lot of them, but some of them had military experience from the First World War, which no Spaniards had. And they were thrown into the forefront of almost every major battle, and they suffered casualties more than three times the rate of the Spanish Republican Army.
Were the survivors welcomed as heroes when they returned to the USA?
By and large, not. They certainly were by their friends and families, but J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was very hostile to them, regarded them as people who'd been soldiers in a communist army.
Even though some of them then enlisted to fight in World War II.
That's right. More than 400 American veterans of Spain joined the armed forces in World War II. Nearly two dozen of them were killed in World War II. In the military, many of them found themselves relegated to rear areas or peeling potatoes. Although some of them, if they had a smart commanding officer who knew, understood, you know, here's somebody with military experience who was smart enough to fight the fascists much earlier.
Now, we don't have much time at all, but do you think that what happened with Hitler and Mussolini might have been different if the loyalists had won?
I think Hitler still would have tried to conquer the world. He mainly had his eye on the East, on Eastern Europe, Russia, the Caspian and Balkan oil fields. But if the Spanish Republic had won, Spain would not have been a de facto ally of Hitler in World War II.
Adam Hochschild will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 at McNally Jackson. That's at 52 Prince Street. You might want to stop by and say hello. His book, which draws its title from something Albert Camus said, is Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard.